This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. As the Olympic Peninsula, in lockstep with most of the nation, enters a new period of elevated risk for COVID-19, with the threat of an overwhelmed healthcare system being forced to ration care, this week on the Compass, we bring back Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke to talk about the safest path forward. I started by asking him for a Jefferson County COVID-19 status report.
The outbreak rate has been slowing slightly in Jefferson County, but we think it's going to be very hard to maintain that, given that we're sandwiched between two sort of much higher prevalence counties, and the I-5 corridor is all of those counties things are really going up and up. So this is really not in control in Washington State. And what we're warning people is that our main control method, which is this very aggressive case investigation and identifying contacts and getting people appropriately isolated and quarantined and then checking with them every day to make sure they're doing what they need to do. And that system only works well when you have fairly low prevalence. But once things start to explode, the system breaks down. You can't investigate all the cases fast enough to make a difference. And you can't identify all the contacts, and you can't test everyone that needs to be tested. And that's what's happening in Washington State. And that's why the governor is once again resorting to this category of things that go by the awkward title of non-pharmacologic mitigations. So things you can do to slow down spread of an infectious disease that don't involve drugs. So that, you know, closing indoor restaurants and limiting group sizes and really strongly encouraging people to shelter at home and stick with their household contacts. But the reality is people are not doing it to the degree necessary to get us back to a low prevalence state. We're fortunate in Jefferson County that I think we do case investigation and contact tracing really well. We have 11 people trained to do it, which is an unusually high number for a county of this size. And moreover, they're extremely skilled and dedicated and hardworking. So I think we're doing the best we can. And a lot of the cases we get are people we've identified as contacts, and so they become positive while they're in quarantine.
Oh, so you've discovered them as a result of the contact tracing.
Right. So they get into quarantine before they become infectious. That's the key to making this work. But to do that, you really have to have a high-functioning system. You have to get people tested early in the course of their infection so that you isolate them during their infectious period. And then you identify their contacts before the contacts become infectious.
One of the things that I've been reading a lot about is the exhaustion of the healthcare workers across the nation. And I think we've been very lucky here in Jefferson County because we haven't really had our healthcare facilities like stretched by this yet. I don't know. I mean, we have at this point at least had some COVID patients at Jefferson Healthcare, right? I mean, for a long time we hadn't.
Right. It's now becoming a regular thing, although not at the maximum level by any means. And I think that's very likely to change. I meet with the hospital incident management group now, you know, three times a week at a minimum. And we're also fortunate that they're young, they're well organized, they're very highly motivated. So I think they're ready for a surge, but it's stressful. They're stressed. Their system is stressed right now. They're working at about 110% of capacity in their outpatient sector, just dealing with all the backlog that accumulated during the days when, you know, sort of March through May into June, when a lot of their services were kind of canceled, when they were only doing emergency services and emergency visits. So they're trying to catch up on that. And the hospital is often filled with non-COVID patients. And that's what makes it so difficult. I think a lot of people imagine that the entire capacity of a hospital is available for COVID patients. And that only makes sense if you want to, you know, kick everyone with a broken hip or acute appendicitis or who needs elective surgery or all these other things that people use hospitals for. That's just not an option to not treat them as well. But all across the nation, all across the state, where the big problem for hospitals right now, it's not the number of physical beds they have, it's the staff to take care of people who are in those beds. And with COVID, you know, I think the exhaustion, I've really been looking into this and trying to address it locally. It's coming from three different sources. It's just that all the extra stuff you need to do now in the hospital in terms of personal protection and equipment and wearing masks all the time and, you know, special procedures, that's kind of exhausting and stressful. And then taking care of COVID patients is really complex and demanding, especially if they're in the ICU, you know, and when they die, it's emotionally devastating. So there's that factor. And then the third thing, I think it really bothers healthcare workers that people are just treating this crisis as if it's, you know, a hoax or overblown or somehow they can have this sort of alternate reality view of it where it's not real and until it affects them. I mean, you've probably heard the stories, and these are real, of people dying of COVID who refuse to believe that that's what their problem is.
I have heard those stories.
Yeah, right. and that just, you know, if you're a healthcare worker, that just drives you crazy to have to deal with that this sort of political, ideologic dimension of it has impacted our ability to respond to the pandemic.
Well, so I guess maybe it's still a little bit early to see whether we're going to have any fallout from Thanksgiving get-togethers, but I don't know. Are we seeing anything from that?
Actually, not yet. We have one outbreak that we're dealing with that looks to be fairly large in a large multi-generational family, but it looks like it started before Thanksgiving, actually. And we'll soon know if it was further accelerated by Thanksgiving gatherings. But it's the median time for developing symptoms after you're exposed to COVID is about 5 to 6 days.
Right.
So sometimes as early as 4 days, but 5 days is the median. So people who are going to get symptoms, which is around 50%, maybe higher, depending on what studies you look at, they'll start to develop symptoms now. And then the people who get really sick and need hospitalization, that typically happens about 2 weeks after exposure. So that won't start showing up till next week.
Right. And for our listeners, now is Thursday, exactly 1 week after Thanksgiving Day. So that's when we're conducting this interview. So we'll see what happens over the next few days. Well, I think one of the things that has everybody excited, has me excited, is the prospect of vaccines rolling out pretty soon. And I know that we're probably still months away from members of the general public being able to get that. But I'm just wondering what the sort of preparations or what you're seeing or know about what kind of vaccines are going to be available here in Jefferson County and when and who they'll go to.
At this point, we are meeting literally every day on this because it's a fast evolving story, and we're a lot of the decisions in terms of prioritization and allocation, you know, the amounts that will be available are out of our control. They will be made at a federal and a state level. It's now looking like Washington State could get as many as 200,000 doses by as early as December 15th. And then additional vaccine by the end of December that may bring, their projections are, could bring the total doses up to 400,000 for the month of December. This is a combination of the Pfizer vaccine and then the Moderna vaccine, which are they both use the same technology, and it's a brand new technology. It's never been used in a commercial vaccine before, where you take a genetic material called messenger RNA that you inject it into a muscle, and it instructs your cells to make proteins that are copies of the surface spike proteins of the coronavirus. And so you develop antibodies to the part of the coronavirus that attaches to your cell and allows it to invade your cells. So it's a very effective strategy for preventing infection if you can develop these very specific antibodies. And the logistics of this are really challenging because it's a two-dose vaccine. So of those initial 200,000 doses, we would like to give them all with the expectation that we'll get more 3 weeks later and can give the second dose. Or for the Moderna vaccine, it's actually 4 weeks later. So we have to plan for two doses, and we have to respect the prioritization decisions that have been made, which mostly I think that's settling down. And it's what's clear is who's going to be first in line are frontline healthcare workers, people whose job it is to put themselves in harm's way and take care of people with this highly infectious disease. So they have the highest risk of exposure. And also, we can't afford for them to be sick as a system. We need to keep them on the job so that they can respond to the needs of the community. And then very high up on the list are the staff and residents of long-term care facilities. And it's because they're at the highest risk of dying from the infection. And then the next group, which is a huge group, is essential workers. And especially essential workers who are at high risk for exposure or, you know, have sort of personal health risks. And then that's another group. Even if you're not an essential worker, but you have these high risk conditions like diabetes, or, you know, if you're a cancer survivor, or it's actually a long list of conditions, chronic obstructive lung disease, that puts you at a much higher risk of complications from COVID, then that's a higher priority group, and on and on. So we've kind of scoped out these four phases of vaccine implementation. And I think we'll be involved in phase one and two for most December through probably February. And then it will start to open up. If the manufacturers can indeed make as much vaccine as they think they can, and the third and fourth vaccines that are under testing, if they come online, they use a different technology. They use a kind of inactivated virus that carries the messenger RNA into the cells, and it's called a viral vector vaccine. And that's the so-called Oxford vaccine, and Johnson & Johnson is making a one-dose vaccine. So the virtue of those is that they're much easier to distribute. You know, they're unfrozen vaccines. You can treat them like any other vaccine. So you can put them in doctor's offices and rural clinics and anywhere. The Pfizer vaccine, which will be the first, is a very fragile vaccine. Yeah, we have to keep it at minus 80 degrees, and you can only open the container for 1 minute twice a day, and things like that. So it's basically, you know, once we thaw it, we have to use it right away.
So let's talk a little bit about, sort of new findings about the disease. There's been a lot of talk recently about the so-called, like, long haulers. And then just last week, there was an article that came out about people having their teeth fall out. And then also about advances in the treatment.
We've learned a lot about the infectivity of it, first of all, is that people are not infectious for their entire illness. It's really about 2 days before you develop symptoms, and then about the first 5 days of infection, and especially the first 3 days after symptoms. that's when most of the transmission occurs. So we're adjusting a lot of our control strategies to account for that. And because we really want to find people when they're most infectious and help them not spread it to other people. The long hauler, the best evidence right now is that about two-thirds of people have fairly uncomplicated illness. They either have very mild symptoms or, you know, maybe in 20 to 40% is what the CDC says. Some other studies say as much as 50% of people have no symptoms at all. But those who do, in about two-thirds of the case, it's over within about 10 days of their symptoms onset. And then another third have these kind of protracted recoveries where it can take weeks and weeks, but eventually they get better. And then there's about the 10% of cases are what have been called the long haulers. You know, it's also called post-COVID syndrome, and where it goes on for months, chronic fatigue, shortness of breath, cough, sometimes very prolonged loss of sense of smell or taste, headaches, confusion. This is poorly understood. Part of it may have to do with damage that the virus has done to your lungs and heart and nervous system. Part of it may be an after effect of your immune system. You know, it's not the virus that damaged your lungs. It was your immune system trying to get rid of the virus. So that's sort of the thought of what's going on with long haulers. And we really don't have any way to treat it. It's just you either get better on your own or you don't. Mm. The treatment for acute disease, especially if you need hospitalization, like you say, has gotten much better. We have some of these new treatment drugs like remdesivir and these monoclonal antibodies, which are not dramatically effective. The studies on them indicate they have some effect, but it's not that dramatic. What is dramatic is the use of steroids. You know, when people start to develop COVID pneumonia, and you give them these very inexpensive corticosteroids that we've had around for decades, that seems to prevent them from getting this extreme lung reaction that ends up putting you into respiratory failure, putting you on a ventilator. So people who take those drugs are less likely to go on a ventilator, or if they need a ventilator, they're on it for a shorter period of time. And then the intensive care doctors have just gotten a lot better in terms of people who are on ventilators, helping them get better and survive. And when we first started out, it was terrifying. 90% of people who needed ventilators were dying on ventilators. Now it's gotten much better. And it's just that learning curve. And we have a real shortage of especially these very skilled respiratory therapists that run ventilators. ICU doctors are in short supply. We can't have them standing by a ventilator all day and constantly adjusting it. So that's really done by these highly skilled technicians. Mm-hmm. And they and the nurses are the ones who keep you alive. They're the ones that determine whether you really survive that ICU experience or not.
Nationwide right now, we're kind of approaching some kind of crisis point, are we not? I mean, you know, we're in good shape in Jefferson County, but I was looking at the map and it's bright red all over right now.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable that the wealthiest and most technologically advanced country in the world would blow it. I mean, we're doing worse than Brazil, and Brazil is doing a terrible job too. It's a surge on top of a surge is what we're seeing. And the healthcare system is going to break down in a number of areas in the country. It's not a might. It will happen that hospitals will have to go to what's called crisis standards of care. And that's just a roundabout way of saying rationing. You decide, you know, who gets the hospital bed, who doesn't, who gets the ventilator, who doesn't, You know, it's triage, and it's trying to use a limited resource to get the most benefit. So the people that are most likely to survive are the ones that are going to get the care. And that's, you know, talk about stress of healthcare providers. You know, it's hard enough to deal with people who are critically ill and some of whom don't make it. When you have to withhold treatment that might save someone's life from that person and then watch them die as a result of it, I don't think there's anything more stressful that you can go through when the whole purpose of your career, you know, your whole motivation is to do the exact opposite of that. And this scars people for life. This causes a kind of a PTSD that people will not quickly recover from. And that's where we're heading in those the Midwest and the Northern Plains states. And it's all the more maddening because it simply did not have to happen. This was a preventable catastrophe. I think we've been a lot more serious-minded about this in Washington State, and our much maligned but recently reelected governor has been absolutely courageous in, you know, following the science. So we're struggling with all the same things that the rest of the country is, and especially with this importation of the disease, you know, the fact that you have these really major outbreak areas in the country and you have all this travel. I don't know what the current numbers are, probably hundreds of thousands of people move back and forth into the state on a daily basis for commerce and, you know, whatever reasons they travel for. And so we're seeing that as a major factor, including in Jefferson County, out of state visitors, you know, staying in your household. We've seen that again and again. And then multiple household members become infected. So we in Washington State, we can control a lot of what goes on in the state, but we're part of 50 other states, and people move back and forth, and at least you know, anywhere from 40 to 42 of those states are much worse off than we are. It's sort of unbelievable to me that people are still arguing about, you know, if requiring someone to wear a mask in public settings is an unacceptable abridgment of their constitutional rights. That just, to a scientist, that makes no sense at all. That says, I have a right to transmit a deadly disease to someone else because it's just too inconvenient for me to not do that.
I don't like the way it feels.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, we're going to run out of time here, but I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the new contact tracing app that actually on the iPhone, you can just go into your settings and turn it on and get notifications if you've been in contact with somebody who was tested positive for the virus. And I mean, when you talk about sort of civil liberties, I have to admit that I myself was a little like sort of dubious before I allowed my daughter to turn it on my iPhone, because I thought, well, do I really like the idea of being tracked everywhere I go? And I was concerned about, you know, like, you know, sort of privacy issues and so on. But I was reassured on that. But I wonder if you would like to talk a little bit about those apps. And
Well, that did go live in Washington State on Monday of this week, November 30th. And it's sort of built into iPhone. You have to download an app called Notify WA on Android phones. And they've really worked to address the privacy issues. So the information about who you've been within 6 feet of for greater than 15 minutes is kind of stored on your phone and their phone, and it only gets activated if we release a code. So when someone is diagnosed with COVID-19, then the local health department has a way of triggering that app. And so the person who's infected, their phone sends a message to the phone of anyone who has met these close contact criteria. And apparently it's all done by Bluetooth technology. Your Bluetooth tells how close you are to other people. It's really uncertain to me how useful this is going to be. You know, we'll use it. We will use the data it generates. If people, we may identify them as a close contact just with our traditional system, in which case the phone app is redundant. But there may be cases where the phone app identifies people we miss, and in which case they're instructed to call us, and you know we'll figure it out and tell them what to do.
Is there anything else that you would like to put out to the public today?
Well, just to really underscore how dangerous things are right now as compared to how they have been. You know, there's a lot of things that people have been getting away with in terms of letting down their guard and, you know, having gatherings and mixing households. And they've gotten away with it because there hasn't been much disease around that they could catch. But that's all changing now. And so things that were safe to do in the summer are not going to be safe to do indoors and in the winter. And that is going to get worse and worse for the next several months. Probably not going to turn around till March or so. So we are in for the most difficult period of the pandemic so far. And then afterwards, there really is light at the end of the tunnel. You know, if we work together, we can bring this to an end by the late spring or early summer. It won't be completely gone, but we'll be able to open things up again. We'll have a substantial amount of the population that'll be vaccinated. But we've got to get through this last final surge, and people have to make sacrifices. They have to cancel holiday plans. They have to forego gatherings with friends and family. They have to curtail their travel. All of these things that we know people are completely fed up with this. We all are. But if we don't do this, it's going to be unimaginably worse. And so it's kind of a stark message, but that's the reality of it. I know we can do this. You know, I mean, this is my specialty is prevention, is preventive medicine, and prevention works, but you have to do it. You have to change behaviors. And right now it's personal behaviors that are driving this pandemic. And so we all have to take responsibility for our personal behaviors and change them in a way that protects ourselves and our families and the community at large.
With Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.